The Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, I'm Frank Thompson. Welcome to episode 33 of The Commentary Track, the podcast that made Broadway gasp. Got a great episode today. Sissy Wellman. Sissy is one of the four daughters of director William A. Wellman. And if you've listened to any episode of The Commentary Track, you know my interest in Wellman is deep and wide. And I have known not all the members of the family. I've never met two of his three sons, but I know all the daughters, or I've met all the daughters, and know his son, Bill Wellman Jr., quite well. I've known him for many, 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 many years. And Sissy is a delight and wonderful to talk with. She has great stories. And in addition to being her father's daughter, and of course we talk about her growing up in the family with Bill and her wonderful mother, Dottie, Dorothy Coonan Wellman. But we also talk about her career as an actress, and she worked with Jerry Lewis and Clint Eastwood and Richard Brooks and Howard Hawks. And so she has a fascinating career of her own. So we begin with talking about her last name, but then we continue with talking about a lot of the other things that she's been involved in. And now she has a theatrical troupe, which consists of people with Down syndrome, and they're called the Born to Act Players. And I'll post the link on the website, thecommentarytrack.com, because they do two shows a year and are always great audience favorites, and people love them, and they are delightful. And you've seen some of the people, some of the actors in that troupe on TV. One was in Glee, and one was an American Horror Story, and they're delightful people and powerful actors, and this has become kind of a labor of love for Sissy. So I want to make sure that I plug that very heavily, and she'll talk about it a little bit and toward the end of the interview. Next week, we'll have an interview with a great American director. Oh, did you hear Pecker the rooster? He's next door. He's in good voice today. For all you college kids, that's a drinking game. Every time you hear Pecker on the commentary track, you take a shot. And for you younger kids or you teetotalers, every time you hear Pecker, you just respond, "Hi, Pecker." And it's fun for everybody. We like to have fun on the commentary track. But as I was saying before, Pecker so... there he is again. So rudely interrupted me. Next week we have an interview with a great American director, and I will tell you more about that on the back end of this commentary track. But 2 weeks from now, and this is purely by coincidence, I didn't mean to schedule them as close together as possible just to spread the wealth a little bit, but Sissy's brother, Bill Wellman Jr., will be on the commentary track, and I had a delightful talk with him yesterday as I record this on Easter Sunday. For those of you who are interested in hearing more about William Wellman, and I sure hope you are, or else why are you listening to the commentary track where he comes up every single episode, I guess, you'll get two good episodes talking about the man and his movies. And I think you'll find them both fascinating, and they both have great funny stories. And Sissy is just a total delight to talk to, and I always have great fun with her. And I think you will, too. So enjoy this talk with Sissy Wellman, and we'll see you on the other side. As you might know, I've given some interest to your father's work. And so I've... Just a little bit. But I was curious about what it was like being one of the kids, because a director's not like a movie star, necessarily. So it's not like you went to school and everybody knew who your dad was, or did they?
No, they didn't. No, at school it was... No, you're right. I mean, being the director, you know, nobody recognized him. He used to laugh about that because he drove this fabulous, what was it, a 53 T-Bird, one of the first ones, and he had it all silver, and he had it stripped of all the metal around it, so it was just, he said, everybody sees this hot car, and then all of a sudden this old guy folds out of it, you know, and that was Dad, but no, and we, because the way we were raised, which I think is the greatest thing in the world, we never felt we came from money or, you know, showbiz, that kind of a big deal.
Sure.
You know, because he was, well, he'd always say, yeah, I want you to know that toilet paper costs money. You know, so we had chores to do, and he says, as long as you're under my roof, they're my rules. And I think the smartest thing he and Mom did is they must have had the conversation before any of us were born. And he said, I'm the breadwinner. I direct. I bring in the money. You take care of the kids. Whatever you say, that's it. You know, so we never could play one against the other. And believe me, we tried. If we want to do something, we go to Dad first. Ask your mother. Shit. You know, okay. That's so that was that.
You aren't telling me that Dottie was harder to reason with than your dad was, are you?
Yeah. They really were good on that. I mean, there were rules. They were, you know, you had things you had to do. You had chores to make your allowance to do around the house. It was all that. And I can only remember when I probably was like 2 years old and I was being held by the nanny as Mom and Dad were going off in motorcycles up the driveway. And it was one of their last trips because they decided, well, now we've got five children, maybe we better hang up our motorcycle boots. And the noise of that, but we always had so darn much fun. Dad loved watching us all play. I mean, at night we'd play kick the can. Mother would jump off a wall to try to free us, and Dad would always point to go somewhere or what to do. He was very competitive, though. He was with us.
That place where you grew up on Brentwood was almost like living in the country, wasn't it? I mean, it was so big, and it was so all these kind of wooded areas and everything. It was as probably as close as you could get in this town to having a country place.
Oh, no, it was. And kids, you say, did you ever go to camp? I said, hell no. Each one of us would have a friend over, and we'd have camp. I mean, it was fun, and we all played together. We all did stuff. I mean, it was barbecues down at the pool. Mom always tracked it down. I mean, it was fun. You know, there were chores. We had the horses, so we always rode around there. And chickens. I mean, we were brought up on a farm in Brentwood, literally. So it was, we were really lucky and blessed. I mean, and Dad always came home. He always had it in his when he was shooting. He always had it in his, you know, his contracts mm-hmm. that he pulled the plug in time. So he was always at home with us for dinner, unless he was on location. And that was, you know, rather great and really different. But we had fun. But Dad could be a terror because he worshipped the ground Mom walked on. You knew that.
Sure.
Yeah. And she
everybody was, did, didn't they?
Yeah. Yeah, she was an amazing lady. She's the perfect definition of a lady. And Dad used to even say that. He said, you know, when you find the right guy like that, he says, remember, always be a lady on the outside, but when you're in the bedroom, you can be a whore. And I go, oh, Daddy, I don't think I want to hear any more of this. Does that mean Mom was new? No.
Yes, no, good fatherly advice.
Yeah, and that picture of Mom being, no, you don't go there.
No.
That's No. But he, you know, if anything happened, she never got sick, and she cooked and did everything for us, made our formals, and he loved it, loved watching her do that, and she never got sick. And if she did, he'd come downstairs, and it would be like, be quiet, because the first one that said, pass the butter, was it. That was it. You know, it was like, well, I don't care about you. You go up, wait on your mother is all I could. Go, okay, right, Dad. Yeah. He was something. Who's the best tennis player? Who's the best golfer? I go, oh, God. And God forbid I had an opinion about it. And he says, remember, if I got mad or upset, he says, remember, you can't feel that way. You're the good-natured one in the family. Oh.
That must have been a burden.
Yeah. One way to stuff feelings. Yeah, Kitty was the favorite, the beauty. Pat was the first. I think he sort of had a... he and Pat didn't get along that well because I think it took away from Mom. You know, it was the first child. It was like, oh. And then Billy came along. It was, okay, son's here. And then Kitty was like Mom a lot, very quiet and everything. And then Tim, it's a rancher. He was just the cowboy that Dad would have loved to have been. I mean, he was everything like that. I came along, was exactly like him. And yes. Because everything he didn't like in himself, he saw in me, and he didn't like in me, and they're really fine in me.
So you had some rough times?
Well, I worshiped the ground he walked on, and I used to always try to buy his love and get his attention and do things, and not always the right way. eating too much at the table, you're going to get fat. Oh, good, attention. Yeah, but he did love my work as an actor.
Well, that's great.
He did do that. He came to when Billy would read with him for a show, he'd have me read with Bill and Younger. And he'd finish reading, and Billy would say, well, Dad, what do you think? He says, well, I'd hire Sissy for the boxer, the manager, And I go, oh, thanks, Dad. Yeah, so he was, he liked that. He pushed me for that way, which was interesting.
When did you become aware of who he was in terms of what he did for a living? Real early on, childhood, or?
You know, as a kid, I really don't know when I did. Because I can remember I've got this, you know, the picture of me sitting on Clark Gable's lap on Across the Wide Missouri. And I must
have been, we all have a picture like that. Come
hello.
On.
Hello. God. 6 or 7, if I had only been of the age to know whose lap I was sitting on, what fun I'd have. But it was all family, you know. It was like Dad had this job. That's all, you know. We got the. Sorry about that.
Ice cream truck
is going by. I never felt much like that because we were all, and it wasn't geared towards friends of Hollywood. You know, when he was with Selznick, yes, we'd go to the beach and to Easter and that kind of thing, to their big family things. But you never felt like it was. It was so non-Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, that motorcycle gang, Andy Devine and his wife were in that, right?
Andy and Dogie.
Who else?
Howard and Slim Hawks.
Oh, yeah.
Bob Taylor and Robert Taylor and Stanwyck. So you had...
That's quite a motorcycle gang.
Wouldn't you love to have been on those rides from Vegas?
Your dad adored Stanwyck anyway. Yeah. I mean, that must have been great fun for them to stick together. You know, she wrote the foreword to my book on your dad.
Oh, I didn't realize. Yes, yeah. I do remember
it's been,
that.
It's
That's
been
right.
so long. It's okay. hard to remember these things. But, yeah, she was crazy about him. And she wrote it from the set of the Thornbirds, I remember. She was,
oh, wow.
Filming that. But... tell me about, you did go on location for Across the Wide Missouri. That's how you ended up sitting on Clark Gable's lap.
Yes.
Do you have any memories of that? I've seen pictures of the whole family there. That must have been pretty unusual for him to bring the entire family along. Why did he do that?
Because he was going to be away too long and he loved the family. So it was just a very simple choice for him. Family comes or, you know, I'm not going to be doing this. Plus, it was a perfect summer vacation. It was done during the summer.
Oh, great.
So we all went to this, and God, it was in Durango, Colorado. Oh, it was a ball. It was. We went, boy, we used to play, what is that game when you're on the shoulder of somebody in the pool and you're pushing at them? And I was on Ricardo Montalban's shoulders, and I'd be fighting against somebody else. And it was just, you know, you weren't on the set when he was actually filming. Because I sure don't remember that.
Yeah.
You know, the only time is certain, you know, being older, you know, like on The High and the Mighty with Duke, I was older. I was like maybe 10 or, you know, like that, 10 or 12. I don't even know. Remember
that's
that.
That's 54. Much. Or I guess he was filming in 53, so.
Okay, so 10. I was 10. because Mikey was the little one that slept all the way through. So he had to have been four. That's perfect. And we were all there, but it was like Pat took us. It was just Pat, Kitty, and I. I've got a picture of the three of us with Duke. And I didn't think much of, you know, who Duke Wayne was. Was I in awe? No, I guess, isn't that horrible to say? But no, I guess I wasn't.
Probably hadn't seen that many of his movies at that time, had you? Or at 10 years old, what?
Yeah, right.
No, those probably weren't the kinds of movies you were going to see.
It was Westerns and stuff like that. So I didn't, but I loved him. I ended up being around him.
Now, your dad used all three of his sons in movies and never used any of the daughters.
Rats.
Now, was that ever a bone of contention, or is that just the way the ball bounced?
You know, it was never, we didn't say, hey, why can't we do it? We never felt that. It was like he had a part where Annie Devine had two sons. Perfect for Mikey and Tim. Boom. And the same with
The Happy Years.
The
Bell Ringer.
Tim.
Yeah.
But it was, that was all it was. It was never, you know, I think he didn't, was it that he didn't like the, he never didn't want us to do it. He never said, I'd rather you do anything else, you want to be an act, whatever. But I don't think any of us started out to be actors, the girls. Pat didn't, never was.
Yeah.
Kitty only did because I think Billy, she was mainly trying to, you know, dancing. And she did the Dobie Gillis, and that was it. And
that's really the only thing she was in?
Yeah. And then she married Jim. She met him at a party and married Franciscus. And, you know, that was it. But she never wanted to do it. I mean, she wasn't really into it.
I just watched that Dobie Gillis the other day. I think I sent you a link to it.
Thank you. I watched it too.
And I thought it was, this is, it's going to be delicate for me to phrase this.
Go for it.
But she acts like she has rehearsed every gesture with every word. You know, I mean, it looks like she does these hand things when she talks. It is very cute.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, I probably should ask her sometime, but it just seems kind of funny. It's like I can see, because I did a little acting when I was younger, that you really think about how to do something, and that's the way she comes off in that she's saying, when I say this, I'm going to do like this.
Okay.
When I say this, I'm going to do like that.
Right.
And but it's very cute, and she's I'm surprised that that's the only thing she ever did.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And Pat never did any kind of acting.
She wanted to be an airline stewardess.
Yeah, so you and Maggie are the only two who ever really gave it a shot. I mean, really,
but I
acted pretty steadily for.
Yeah, and I don't think, I know, I can't speak for Mag, but I didn't start out doing it. I wanted to be an airline stewardess. And I wanted to see the country. Stage 7, Florida. What can I tell you? I'm Paramount. No, but it happened with Francis D., who, I got a call. I think I was in the kitchen. I must have been 16. And it was from NBC. And mom hands me the phone. She says, NBC. I said, oh, yeah, right. You know, hello. We want to see what I said, all right, who is this? What is this about? No, we have an interview for you. Frances D is doing this pilot. It's called Amy. And she said she thinks you'd be wonderful in it. And I went, okay. So I went out, and I took a look at, when I got there, I was reading this thing, and it was called Amy, and there were Nancy and a Linda or something, and so I just walked in the door where they were, the producers, and I said, which part do you want me to look at? Is it Linda or Nancy? Like that? They said, oh, no, Amy. I said, oh, no, I can't do that. That's the lead. And they said, just wait by doing that. They went, Frances is right. She's absolutely right for this. I went, oh, God. But, it, you know, it never went. But that's really what started the ball rolling for me, because then agents, people started finding out about it. Then it was in a column. I mean, then it, William Wellman's daughter. And
yeah.
I was going, well, why not? And then I had fun. You know, that was the part of it. It was, I got lucky.
Now, is Redline 7000 the first feature you're in?
No. The first feature I did was with Jerry Lewis, was Disorderly Orderly.
Oh, okay.
I had a great role on that one. I had fun with that. No, that was the first one.
I thought
one.
That would have been switched. Yeah, no. Bill Jr. worked with Jerry several times.
A lot.
So was that, did that have anything to do with why you're in Disorderly Orderly?
Yeah, Bill took me in and introduced me to Jerry. And they started shooting, and Jerry said, oh, great, you're perfect. Come on, you'll play. I said, okay.
Now,
he used to do, he used to play.
Now, Jerry knew your dad, right? Didn't they? I mean, I saw pictures of him at one of your dad and mom's parties.
At the house?
Yeah.
No, Billy had invited Jerry over to meet Dad and Patty when he was married to Patty then. And I was there. Billy and Flossie were there, I think, and Mom and Dad, of course. And I think that was it. And it was fabulous because Jerry, who knows every camera angle and he gets very technical about shots, and he was talking with Dad about one of the shots he did in this film and the angle that and the meter and Daddy was just looking at him with this deadpan look. And we just looked and we just started laughing because Daddy, and the minute Jerry started describing it with his hands and showing it, Dad went, oh yeah, you mean that shot, this shot. It was being an interpreter for the two men. It was great. They got along. It was interesting. It was fun.
Well, Jerry, yeah, from everything I know about him, he really took an interest right away in the technical aspects of filmmaking.
Very much.
And he turned out to be a great director. I mean,
yes,
really terrific director.
He was fun to work with.
So how much time did you spend on that set, and what do you remember about being directed by him?
Oh, I love working with Jerry. Because Billy and I were both, mainly me, that had really a role in it. There were extras that, you know, we were just walking around and just doing lines, but I really had a part in it with Karen Sharp. And Jerry would do things that, we were at the Greystone Mansion is where we shot it. We were on that location for about 10 weeks. We were all there together.
Wow.
But Jerry would do, if you have a close-up, and Jerry's directing, it's your close-up, and you have to react to him. Come in. He'd open up a door, and he'd come in with people. He'd come in with a skeleton. He'd come in with something just trying to crack you up. And I learned very early, he taught me some of the best things in comedy, and that's to look at his left ear or his right ear. It looks like you're looking at his eyes, and you don't crack up. Plus, I had a lot of nail marks in my palms from trying not to. He was wonderful, but he had that playback.
Yeah.
So he watched it. That was one of the firsts.
Yeah, he developed that video playback.
Yeah. So it was wonderful.
Or was it playback? He could look at it on video.
Yes. That's what.
Yeah, it didn't hone until to a playback until a little later. But,
right. But he had.
But
that.
he's the inventor of that.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know what an impact he's had on even
movie
making today. Yeah,
amazing. And I did Three on a Couch with him, a quick thing. He just called me. He said, you want to come play? And I said, sure. And I just went in. There was an elevator sequence. It was hysterical. So that was it. Just
now, when he was on the Paramount lot, he always had an open stage. When you were at the mansion, the Greystone Mansion, did he just let people come in and watch, or was it more closed. Isolated? Yeah,
it was closed because there was so much going on. You couldn't have people up there, and that's.
Yeah,
I was showing him around because that's where I played as a kid. Because Dee Dee Doheny was one of my schoolmates, one of my best friends, still is, and that's before any of Truesdale existed. It was all five houses.
Wow,
there were the Dohenys, and they were 5 miles apart, and that was Sweethearts, the grandmother's house. And so I played there. So I was taking Jerry and everybody down to show him the secret places. It was fun. He was fun. He made what Dad used to do. You know, you worked hard, but you played hard. And that's what I loved.
Yeah, I get that impression. I know a lot of people who know him and that he can turn on a dime and be very pleasant 1 second and not very pleasant for another second. But everybody I've talked with who worked with him have always just said nice things, that it was great to work with, and he was just always having fun and always being very loose and playing jokes and things and just having a good time.
Yeah, and he always had – but I think, if anything, Jerry's, if you want to call it a problem, was that people didn't get – is I think he tried to be everything to everybody, tried to fulfill everything, and you just can't.
Sure.
So then you'd have those people who say, well, he said he was going to do this, and he didn't. Well, you can only do 25 things in one day. He wanted to do 28. And I think that was Jerry just trying, doing too much. And I don't think that's a negation. I think that that's, you know, that's great. But a lot of people who didn't benefit from that had problems with that. And yet Jerry helped me in a lot of ways because he always had a camera. When we were on breaks, he would have just a regular camera, and he'd be going around and snapping. And then he'd call each one of us in, and he would talk about it. He says, see this? He says, see, you don't even know what camera's being on here, and look at this. He said, that's what we want over here. He'd do that to all of us. He was my best acting teacher by doing that. You know, it was like, whoa, I wasn't aware I was not doing that. So it was really, I adore him, you know, and I got a lot.
I'm a big supporter of his, and I think he has not gotten nearly enough credit even now as how good he was as a director. Forget being an actor and a comic and all that, but as a filmmaker. He did terrific things and innovative things.
Right. Well, Frank Tashlin was his director. Sure. And that's he had Tash. Tash was directing that. But Jerry was, you know, part of that too. That's why he was watching everything. But he would kid Tash, call him the walrus, you know, and the walrus would just sit there and hardly smile and just, you know, with this big. It was wonderful to watch. I loved Tashlin.
Oh, yeah.
Tashlin was just. And he paid me one hell of a compliment. He said, if I were doing Susan Slept here this day and age, you'd be my girl. And I went, oh,
that is a good one, yes.
Thank you. Can we do a remake? Anything? God.
Well, Tashlin was the perfect director for Jerry because he had been an animator, and so it was he had the right sensibility. And I think a lot of those films, I mean, the reason I think of Disorderly Orderly as being almost a film that Jerry directed is that it's kind of those transitional times because when I've talked with other people, there was a time when Tashlin was still there, but Jerry was kind of moving in until finally he just took over.
Right.
And he'd already directed before that. I mean, he'd The Bellboy and all that. I mean, Jerry had already directed before Disorderly Orderly. He had already directed his own films, and pretty soon it was only going to direct his own films. So,
I know.
Now, you got into Redline 7000. obviously, you had known the Hawks family probably all your life, right? Your dad had certainly. I mean,
but they were never at the house. I never saw them at the house. No, I just knew. I had an interview with Howard to meet him for Redline, and this is the one story I'd like to say. Oh, damn! I wish I had done the other than what Dad said, because he was doing Redline, and he wanted me. I wanted to test for the Laura Devon part. Did you see it? Do you remember the part?
Sure.
Well, she's a tomboy.
Yeah.
Laura wasn't a tomboy. I am a tomboy, you know, with the hair, the looks, the whole thing. But he was telling me about her test because he was saying, you know, about my test, how much he liked it and da-da-da-da, and about it before I was going to do it. And so I told this to Dad. And Dad said, you know, if he already has somebody he really likes, get a chance to work with Hawks. He's around. He's one of the best. So why don't you just tell him, hey, I'm not going to test. I want to do something on the film. I don't care what it is, so I can be with you. Damn. I would have loved to have had that film in the beginning of my career. I would have loved to have had that piece. I loved Howard. I used to always get him. I think he had me around as the joke because he always, you know, went for these tall, skinny, slender women, you know, the lean. And I used to go up to him all the time. I'd say, am I really tall and slender and I've been kidding myself all these years? And he'd say no and turn around and walk away. And I said, thanks. You know, I adored him. Plus, he knew I was a dancer, so that I staged that one dance number. He didn't know that. I staged that. That was my
Wildcat Jones is the name of the number.
Yes.
And it's a god-awful song.
It's the worst.
Yeah, just horrible.
And Gail's we were all just dying. And he hired, the two original girls that he hired as actresses looked great in pants and tights, the whole look, couldn't move. And I went to Howard. I said, Howard, you're killing me. I said, you want me to teach dancing also on it? And I said, because they can't move. And if you've got literally can't move. And they admitted it. And he says, oh, all right, sis, how far we'll fire them? And who do you need? Who do you want? And I said, I got the two gals, but they're not extras. They have to go with SAG contract. And it was Terry Garr and Roberta Tennis, because we all danced together. And she was, Terry, I used to get so mad at her. I'd say, for God's sakes, quit. You're extra dancing. You're too damn funny. I used to call Howard in all the time going, do that again in front of Howard. She just is a naturally funny lady. Damn. And she was, so I got Terry doing it with me, and we had a little bit of fun with that. But, oh, God, it was atrocious.
Well, for the people who have never seen it, and I would say most people have never seen it.
Jimmy Conn wants to burn it. We're going to have it in effigy.
I don't think the movie's too bad. I think the movie itself has got a lot of good things to it. But I love Hawks anyway. So.
Oh, me too. Can I tell you a story on dailies with him? The one where he liked us all to come to dailies. So there's the one scene with Laura Devon, and her boyfriend's left her or something, and she's crying, and she's just had her hair done, and she's crying. And it's Gail Heyer. Laura, Gail Heyer, Charlene Holt, myself, I think another one. And it's this crying scene. Everybody's crying. Well, we're watching it in the dailies, and Howard's behind us. And all of a sudden, Gail came in late to the dailies, and she was standing there and watched like three shots or, three takes of this lady's crying. She went, oh, God, that's awful. And started laughing. We all started laughing hysterically. And then when the lights came up, we went, oh, my God. Papa Hawks is right behind us. And with that, we still hear somebody laughing and blowing their nose. It's Howard. And he says, we'll be doing retakes on this. I loved him. I've got a lot of stories.
I think he's one of the great directors, obviously. And I've always been curious about that film in particular because he's so great with actors always. And none of the actors in this quite come up to snuff. I mean, certainly James Caan is a great actor, but he didn't start out as a great actor. And he was not quite. He's a this and an El Dorado with Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not quite there yet, but... I've often wondered if Hawks just didn't care at this point, or if it just wasn't a subject that he felt that into. Although he loved race cars, I mean that was a big thing for him.
But the main reason he did is because of his son.
Ah,
his young son who was in the race cars. He did this film because of his son.
Well, there you go.
But I think it is the age also because we used to listen. He with Jimmy Caan. I even said it to him, Howard, because he would never. Tell him to, it was the pauses, the pregnant pause, and it's like a director's job is to, come on, let's pick up the pace, let's do something. And a lot of it, I think it was just the age also, because he wanted to do that, especially for his son. Yeah. That's why he did the race cars, because he was so into it.
Now, you remained close with Hawks for a
We were very good friends.
Yeah.
I used to go down and spend weekends with him. I loved the man. We'd go fishing together in the little trout stream. And then he would, I was then married to Bob Donner, and Bob would be on locations. And I would spend time with Howard because I introduced Donner to Hawks, and Hawks put him into Redline 7000 and also used him in Rio Lobo.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was it. That's when we decided to get married. And Howard, used to spend as much time as I could with a man. He was like the father I really didn't have in my dad. And dad used to be jealous about.
Really?
Like, you're going to go down and spend another weekend with Howard. It was like, what? I said, well, yeah. You know, he loved me for me. He loved my craziness, you know, and extrovertedness. And, you know, he loved that.
Well, were Hawks and your dad friends, or were they just acquaintances? I mean, obviously they must have known each other forever, but.
Oh, yeah.
Were they people who hung out together or anything?
Dad didn't really hang out with anybody. Hmm. It was the family. It was mom and, you know, the kids. And mom was his best friend. They motorcycled together. They went fishing together. They went golfing together. So, you know, it was really Frank Capra's were their best friends. Frank and Lou Capra were their best friends. And they lived just down the street from us. That I remember more. And with Howard down in Palm Springs one time, we put on a dinner. Howard and I put a dinner on, and we had Frank and Lou Capra over, and George Kirgo. Do you remember George Kirgo?
No.
He wrote Red Line 7000.
Oh. Hmm.
George and Terry Kirgo, his wife. And it was just us for dinner, and the story started going, and George was going, I don't have a tape recorder. I'm going to kill myself. Really, it was just so great having those stories going back and forth. And a Hawk story, whether it's true or not, because he told me, one of my favorites, was because he directed all of the Bogart Begal films, as you know, Big
sure.
Sleep and all of them. And Michael Curtiz, they were very good friends. And they had lunch together one time at the studio, and they were under different studios. I don't know which ones, but and Howard did not want to do the next picture he was going to do, and Michael Curtiz didn't like his next picture, and they started talking about their stories and why not, and all of a sudden in the telling of the stories, Michael was going, oh, I like yours, and Howard was going, oh, I like yours, and they traded. They went to their respective heads of studio and said, we just want to switch. They said, fine. You know, and because of it, Howard Hawks did Sergeant York, and Michael Curtiz did Casablanca.
Wow.
And I sort of like that story.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow.
Yes. Is it true? Who knows? But I like it.
Yep. Howard told me so, but, you know, they never stretch anything.
Oh, that's for sure.
As far as a kid knew, I was living on a 5-acre farm in Brentwood. Dad passed, and all of a sudden it was 3 acres.
Well, 5 acres sounds better in a story.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, I found, you know, because I've researched your dad's career for so long, longer than he had a career, I think. I've found, you know, I've tracked down a lot of his stories and found that some of them are a little stretched or a little this or that. And, you know, it was a different time when those, you know, when your dad was being interviewed, say, in the 50s.
Okay.
There wasn't anybody like me or like, you know, who was asking real questions, you know. They wanted stories. They wanted, and so, you know, that's what your dad did. I mean, he was a storyteller. He was a yarn spinner. And I must say, of course, as you know, Beau Geste was the big bang in my life.
Yeah, I love that.
But that Men Who Made the Movies episode was what really sold me on your dad, because he was just such a great guy, you know,
yeah.
Just such a great storyteller, such a vivid personality and all that. Now, I wonder about that. It's just occurring to me right now that starting about then, your dad started getting a lot of attention for his body of work that not from me, I was too young at that time, but from those who came just before me, Kevin Brownlow and, of course, Richard Schickel,
oh, yeah.
Who really did the great thing for
everybody.
With that series.
Yeah,
great episode on Hawks, too.
Well, I think Daddy and Hawks were the two most versatile of all the directors.
Yeah. Oh,
if
I think
look at
so.
Their
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, and I love that story. I think Schickel tells it in the book version of Men Who Made the Movies when they were in New York doing promos for PBS. All the directors who were there. And I think it was Hawks, your dad, and Walsh.
Was it Walsh? Okay.
I think that's the three who were there. And he said at one point, your dad was filming or taping a, you know, watch Men Who Made the Movies and give money to PBS, that kind of thing.
Oh, and, okay. Wow.
And they were standing next to the monitor, and Hawks turned to Schickel and said, remember what I said about some people having a face that the camera loves? And then he just stuck a thumb at the monitor. It's like, there's one, you know. And your dad did. He could have had an acting career, I think, if he had. But he had the looks for it.
Oh, yeah. He did. He did.
And he showed up in more movies than you would think. Because once I started compiling all the times when he makes cameo appearances.
Really?
Or. Yeah. And his voice shows up a lot.
Oh, that's.
Quite a lot.
Great voice.
Yeah.
Boy, you know, you can't even beat that voice.
There's that great scene in, oh, shoot, the name just went out of my head, with Walter Houston and Chick Sale. Chick Sale is walking down the street, and a voice comes out of a manhole, and Chick Sale leans over and has this conversation with somebody down in the manhole, and it's your dad. It's clearly your dad.
I didn't know that.
And, but he appears on screen several times. As a matter of fact, I contend, and I dare anybody to knock me over on this, because I contend it's true, that your dad was the most consistently autobiographical filmmaker who ever lived, or at least who ever worked in Hollywood, because there are references to his own specific life in more movies. You know,
really?
Yeah, in The Conquerors, there's his plane with the black cat insignia on it. In Thunderbirds, there's the photo of him as John Sutton's father, and then the painting of him as John Sutton's father on the wall.
Right.
And on and on and on. And, you know, he narrates Lafayette Escadrille, he narrates Goodbye, My Lady, narrates Gallant Journey.
Island in the Sky.
And...
Yeah,
and then just all these references, and of course his kids show up repeatedly, and so it's, you know, he there were people like Hitchcock who would show up in their movies, but your dad put things about himself. I mean, specific things about his own life.
Wow.
In more movies than anybody, I can't think of anybody else in Hollywood filmmaking terms who did as much of that sort of thing as he did.
Wow, I never even thought of that. So that's, wow.
Yeah, it's all over the place. And of course, he's in Wings. And
I know, we're going and speaking about it and showing Wings. I mean, everybody in the audience, when that comes up, it's like, there's Dad, pointing at the screen.
And of course, his wife at the time is in it. And the their adopted daughter.
Yeah.
Who had a weird life, apparently. I don't know.
Did
you ever run into her at all?
It was very weird because they had, as a kid, boy, you just brought things up. Confidential, remember the Confidential magazine?
I have that magazine, yeah.
The one about Dad and the dog.
Yeah.
We didn't know, that's the first time we even heard about it. And I was young. And I'll never forget the closed door up at Mom and Dad's suite. They were talking, you know, it's like apparently how to address it to us. And it was like, wow, that was very weird.
Yeah. Yeah, it's apparent. I don't know that much about it. There's no records about it. But apparently they adopted her, he and Marjorie
Chapin. LCs.
And then when they divorced, she kept the little girl and apparently just took her out of your dad's life, and it's...
Never saw her.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever
strange,
seen.
Yeah. But there's a story there, but nobody knows it.
Are you kidding? There are so many different stories, you know.
Yeah.
With Dad, with what's gone on. Good Lord. Lafayette Escadrille. I mean, all the different... His, just the ones we know about. And when you think about it, my gosh, what fun. I love the one, did you, the Ernie Pyle one?
Which one?
With Dad. when Ernie Pyle, the one person he wants to meet is W.C. Fields.
Oh, yeah.
And he takes him up to Fields, and Fields has got a shotgun, and he's looking down the driveway at Dad, and he says, "Are you drinking? Are you on the wagon or off the wagon?" And Dad says, "I'm sorry, I'm on the wagon." He says, "Then you can't come up." You know, I mean, would you love to have been in that place at that time? I mean, geez, all the different things with Gene Fowler when they were doing the real story of Buffalo Bill and then burning it because the kids.
Yeah.
God.
That must have been an interesting neighborhood to live in because there were a lot of people. Fred McMurray and June Haver lived up there. And,
right there and across from
the Andrews sisters.
Yes, they were
Gary Cooper.
The corner.
Gary Cooper lived...
Cesar Romero.
Right around the curve there at some point. Yeah, very... those were the days to just walk down the street in Brentwood and see the cream of Hollywood.
It's true.
Yeah.
But the ones that we're talking about, you know, weren't that known. Because nobody recognized Dad, Fowler...
Capra.
Capra was more recognizable because of he was more social in the Hollywood scene also. But he, and he and Mom and Dad used to hang out. And George Chandler was Dad's other best friend.
Oh, sure.
Friend, you know, but that was it.
Let me tell you a story about Chandler. For those who don't know, George Chandler was a great character actor. He appears, I keep forgetting the exact count, but more than 30 films he made with your dad.
Right.
Usually in just minor bit parts. Sometimes, like in Roxy Hart, a real role. But sometimes he's, like in Light That Failed, he's just sitting there. He doesn't do a thing. He just sits there in the room. But he's almost always there. And what your dad always said was that he kept Chandler around because... If your dad ever got stuck on something, he didn't want to look weak in front of the company, so he would give Chandler the high sign. Chandler would mess something up, giving your dad an opportunity to yell at him and then storm off the set. And then Chandler would go, sorry, you know. But it was actually Chandler deliberately giving him a chance to get off the set, and then he could work out whatever problem he was going to do, and he'd come back.
Wow.
So when I first came out here... in 79 to do my first wave of research on your dad. Sad to say, after your dad had already passed away, I never met him.
Oh,
but
forgot that.
But I did come out and meet Dottie and meet Bill, and so, you know, good things happened. And I went to George Chandler's house and told him what I was working on. He said, "Oh yeah, come on up." So I went up there, and he was so nice and everything. He would not tell me one thing. Not one thing. He said, as soon as I got there, sat down, gave me a cup of coffee. My wife was with me. We had a nice little chit-chat. And he said, "Well, I want to tell you something. I'm writing a book of my own." And so I don't want... And I said, "Well, this will probably come out much later after your book. I'm just starting this." And so I'd ask him about something. He'd say, "Oh, that's a great story. Man, what a great story that is. It's in the book." So I'd try something else, and he'd say, "Oh, man, that was, you wouldn't believe that story. It's in the book." Yep. And, of course, you know, he died a couple of years after that, and there was no book. There's no book.
You're kidding me.
No, there's no book. He was thinking about doing a book, but he didn't write
a book. Oh, now that's funny.
Yeah. So it was so annoying because of all the people I talked with, and I talked with people who knew your dad really well, Charlie Barton, who I became very good friends with, and Joe Youngerman. I talked to people who worked with your dad a lot.
Right.
But Chandler, 30-something films. Yeah. It would have been great.
Yeah.
And he gave me nothing. Not one. Not one at all. Except the pleasure of sitting in his living room for an hour and getting nothing from it. So.
Oh, wow.
It's so annoying.
Well, the other person that used to do that was Richard Brooks. Because Richard Brooks had that horrible reputation, and he... I introduced Dad to Richard, and come up there. They fell in love with each other. It was so fabulous because I said, oh, my God, this is going to work or it's not, because Richard is so liberal and mm-hmm. Pat is so conservative. And, man, they started telling, it was just fabulous how they do it. But I would ask Richard, you know, what do you do? How do you work a set? What do you do? Because the last one he did, which I loved, good sis, the Western with Gene Hackman and Bite the Bullet. Bite the Bullet. I loved it. I think it's one of the most not seen films. He was always ahead of his time, I think. Richard was, Brooks, with his writings and his stuff. But he had that reputation of the yeller, screamer, ranter, raver. But then he'd forget about it. And he had that on the set. He'd have somebody in the crew that he would work with, and somebody would be a little hesitant about doing something, and he would take it out. And everybody gets silent, and then my then-husband, Donna, would come up and say, oh, Jesus, Richard! God, get over yourself. So, and everybody would get silent, and Richard would just crack up because they became good friends. But it's interesting. It's very interesting how they had to do that. I didn't know that about Dad.
I guess they all had tricks that they used. And that was, when you think about it, that was a real nice thing for your dad to do. Because he didn't want to look bad. He didn't want to be sitting in front of the crew thinking, just saying, I don't know what to do next. Or I don't know what to do about this shot.
I thought it was more of the anger thing. Oh,
well, that's why I did that. Yeah, that's why he pretended to get mad with Chandler so that he could leave the set. He could storm off.
Oh, so he could come up with...
Yeah, and then go to his trailer or whatever and then sit there and figure out what he was supposed to do. But it was, you know, that was smart. It was just...
That's a great story, because Richard Brooks is this almost the same way. Yeah. When we were driving, there was a week left shooting, and I drove up in our little Porsche, and Donna was driving. I was in the middle, and Richard is in the passenger seat, and we're on our way to dinner, and he's sitting there going, so what is it? He says, gotta come up with an ending. Haven't figured out who's going to win the race. I said, what? You haven't done what? I mean, he would sit there going, no, and it would a lot depend on who, if he liked whoever it was. He liked them both so much the same that if you remember, it was a tie. But you hear that and you go, oh, my God.
Yeah. You'd think they would have worked that out before starting the movie, wouldn't you?
Well, Richard learned, he never gave a script out.
Yeah.
And I talked Gene Hackman into doing it. Hackman said, we were playing tennis, and he said, you know, Brooks wants me to do this, but he won't even give me a script. I said, oh, Gene. I said, there's nobody left. There's a Richard Brooks, and that's about it. And you'll get 10 pages and take a look at his work. Go for it. And thank God he did. I mean, it came out, we figured, at the same time as Jaws, literally. And that killed it. Nobody went to see that. Everybody went and took their friends to see Jaws and everything else. But, man, I just thought it was an incredible piece of work.
Brooks was an awfully good director, that's for
writer
sure.
And director. Yeah. He wrote and he was always ahead of his time, in most cases. Interesting.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff.
Yeah, I wanted Maggie and me to do his Looking for Mr. Goodbar.
Boy, that was a depressing movie. Phew.
That in Cold Blood.
It was a good movie.
He does a lot of those. Yes.
Oh, I saw In Cold Blood, I guess I must have been 14, 15, something like that, when that came out.
Hello.
And... man, I was creeped out for a long time after that.
Yes.
But, boy, what good filmmaking that is. And it really does. It's one of those movies that really does seem to be actually happening as you're watching it.
Yes.
It doesn't seem like a movie. It seems like something that you're having to watch, you know, that you're experiencing.
That's why it's so hard.
Yeah.
I love the professionals of his also.
Oh, yeah, me too.
I mean, there are a lot of... you know, very interesting ones. But Dad, you know, Dad made all those different varietied ones. That's what was so fabulous.
He did, God. Yeah. He was, you know, I've always been kind of the spoil sport about that I remember when the documentary Wild Bill, Hollywood Maverick was being made, and a lot of people would say that, and I would always get in arguments with them because I would say, well, there's a lot of things that he never made. You know, he never made a horror movie, never made a science fiction movie, never made a musical, really. I mean, Lady of Burlesque, kind of.
And but, Roxy Hart well, was
it's got a song.
Bit. Yeah, well, that's...
You know, it's got a number in it, but it's not like Singing in the Rain. It's not like a musical, no.
No.
And, but, you know, he was a versatile director, and when I started to broach this a little earlier, when in the early 70s, there started to be more attention paid to him as a director. I mean, the Schickles and all these people. And then, of course, his autobiography comes out in A Short Time for Insanity. Mm-hmm. And do you remember that? I mean, did he feel like, was it gratifying that people were valuing his work as a body of work, or did it mean much to him one way or the other?
I don't think it did. You know, it's like, I don't know if it did or not. I never got that aspect of it. It's like, boy, I don't know. It's, all right, he got the D.W. Griffith Award, right?
Yes.
That was because of Richard Brooks.
Hmm.
Richard got that done because when he heard with Dad that you haven't gotten these things, he was the one that really did that.
Yeah.
Went and got that done, which is...
That's great.
Great. And, but... Too many Christmas. That's really interesting.
Because Kevin Brownlow devotes a chapter to him in his book, The Parade's Gone By, which is a
still... Well, he didn't have an ego. Like, if anything, he had an insecurity. Yeah. You know, he really did.
And then there was that big retrospective of his films in 74, where they showed, I think showed 40-odd... of his movies. I have I have a big poster from it.
Wasn't that the Music Hall or something? Where was that?
Maybe. I'm trying to think now
was
where
that
it
was. Was that the Tom Laughlin one that Tom got going?
Yeah. I think Tom Laughlin helped sponsor it.
Get that
and
going. Right.
And then your dad would come and do Q&A
yes.
after some of them.
Yes.
But it seemed like, I mean, that's a change from the kind of life that he lived up to that point as a director, where, you know, every once in a while you get invited to the Academy Awards or something like that, but you didn't have a lot of, you know, audience interaction. And then suddenly, you know, because of Men Who Made the Movies, and that book came out, and there's a chapter about him in that book.
Right.
And so he starts to become, you know, people start thinking about him.
But it never, he and never I just had wondered that. If, it never went to his head. You know, it was like he didn't realize it. Be honest with you, I mean, because he did two Merv Griffin shows.
Yeah.
And on those, oh, God. I'll never forget the one when he did the thing on Streisand, which just blew my mind because he hadn't seen her. Do you remember that?
No.
All the interviews? Merv asked him with all the beautiful Hollywood women that he had directed and, you know, the Stanwyck's, you know, the Carol Lombards and all that. What do you think about today's leading ladies?
And I do kind of remember that.
And Dad's, you know, it just, he went back on again and apologized for it because then he saw it. But he said, because then Merv, I think, said something like, what do you think, you know, Barbara Streisand? He says, with that face and that nose, he said, come on, you're going to talk. Really? But he hadn't seen her. He hadn't seen Funny Face yet.
Yeah.
And when he did, I mean, Funny Girl, he flipped out. He went on the show again and said, sorry, she's brilliant. You know, it was that kind of, but Dad was that kind of, you almost had to watch out what he was going to say and hope that there was an editor there for him to say, don't say that, you know.
Well, your brother Bill told me one time that he was in the audience for the Merv Griffin shows.
Yes, he was.
And
most of all of us went.
He said the Merv Griffin people hated him because he would, you know, your dad would start talking about John Wayne's fairy walk and that sort of thing.
Yes.
And Bill would say, now, Dad, you know, John Wayne's been very good to you. And the Merv Griffin people would say, shut up. Let him be outrageous. That's what we want him to be.
Oh, absolutely. But, and he was, but wonderfully so.
Yeah.
Well, because, you know, he could tell a story better than anybody. He just had a great look, a great way about him. He was charismatic, doesn't describe it totally.
I always, you know, I really like the documentary that they made.
There was no humor. I say that?
Yeah, I'll say it too.
Oh, God.
But I thought it really was a miscalculation that they didn't have any footage of him in it, of him being interviewed, because he was such a personality.
I agree.
And like I said, when I saw him on Men Who Made the Movies, I just fell in love. That's, you know, he was such a great guy. You know, he told great stories. I loved the movies already, the ones that I'd seen, which at that point in my life, being, 20 years old or 21 years old, I'd only seen a few of them.
Right.
But that was what made me start thinking, oh, this guy is somebody to look into. You know, a few years later, I'm writing a book about him. So,
love that.
It's right after that. But, you know, I always thought it was a big mistake. I don't know. They kept explaining to me why they didn't want him in the documentary, but
I don't get it either, because it's ridiculous. There's so many beautiful pieces on him to see. It's a documentary about him. And yet we're seeing his works and in the times that it affected it or whatever. But Dad was so...
Yeah.
So charismatic. There's another way we go again, the same word. But he was fascinating that you want to say, I hadn't seen the Men That Made for a long time. And then it just came, we just got a copy of it, or I just got sent it or something like last year, a year before last. I hadn't seen it since it was on.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting there watching Dad in, you know, the library, and there he is, and it's just... He is just so, I'm his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
How lucky can I be? You know, that's really it.
Yeah. Very lucky.
We had a good time. You know, for the little idiosyncrasies at that time, which are my attitude and how I dealt with things, you know, he was so cute. Dad's kind of thing would be, oh, God, I think I was 18. I was dancing on the Andy Williams show. And he had me in the living room, pulled me into the bar area, and he said, you know, because Kitty was the favorite, the beauty, everybody was this, that. And he said, you know, it is amazing, but you have turned into the beauty of the family. And I wanted to look at my hand at the watch saying, could you have done this about 10 years ago so I don't have this, I don't need a therapy? He said, yeah. He said, it's with your looks and your hair and your color, when you walk into a room and all eyes are on you, beat, beat, beat. And then you open your mouth and fuck it up. That's Dad. So there's the good and the bad. So,
well,
okay, what, you know, don't know how to react to that. So that was Daddy. And he said, of course, you know, you say, don't you love me at all? He said, of course I love you. I'm just a cantankerous old son of a bitch. You know, in his when he wrote to me in his book, you know, he autographed it to all of us. And he said, if it just has half your enthusiasm, this book will be a success. Well, that gets me.
That's, sure.
You know, and I know he comes. You know, I just, you know, I used to, when he'd come to see me dance, he'd do that. He just loved it. And when he'd come watch me, I mean, that, I was blessed to have had that appreciation that he loved, you know,
and
to do that.
He did have, as you said earlier, just such a love for his family. And
major.
And I always thought it was fun. I never had that big an extended family. And then the times that I would be over there, when there would be 50 people, it seems like there would just be this mob of grandkids and everything. I remember, this is kind of off subject, but it just reminds me, when I was at the Brentwood house for dinner one time, I was out on a visit. So this must be in the mid-80s, I guess. And there were five or six people there. I mean, Bill and his family, Flossie and everybody, and their kids, and seemed like a couple, somebody else. But Dottie was making dinner, of course.
Always.
And you know, there's that big lazy Susan in the middle of the table there. And she went out, and she was gone for quite a while in the kitchen. For quite a while. It seemed enough that we all noticed that she'd been gone for a little bit. And then finally she came back in and she said, oh, sorry, they were playing Shadow Waltz on the radio, and that's the music, that's the number we were shooting when I met Bill. And I got a little misty, she said. So,
isn't that lovely?
Yeah. And I thought that was very sweet, and I get a little misty whenever I think about that. So.
Yeah.
I was crazy about Dottie. We had, there was the Wellman retrospective in Spain at the San Sebastian Film Festival in 93, and we were flown over for it. This was one of the great experiences. That book didn't sell 5 copies, and no human on earth ever read it, but it got us this trip to Spain, and they reprinted it in this beautiful Spanish edition, and we were in Spain for like 2 weeks.
Ooh.
But I'd say half the nights that we were there, Claire and I would have dinner with Dottie and at the hotel restaurant, and Bill and Flossie were always out in the town somewhere, and we would always go with Dottie and just sit there and talk. And
isn't she
is the most wonderful person.
Isn't she just gorgeous?
And the weird thing was, when we were shooting the documentary, and I say we advisedly because I was there, but I didn't. I contributed my expertise, but they didn't want any of my input. But
their mistake.
I was there, but I'm not. That's not a push at all. That's
my
just
feeling.
No. Yeah, just fact.
Yeah.
But we were there with Dottie when we were shooting her in the living room of the Brentwood house, and I remember sitting there being so nervous because I didn't think she was saying anything, and I just they'd ask her a question, and it seemed to me that she was just going, yeah, no, something like that. And I was thinking, somebody's got to figure out some way to get her to talk. But then when they cut it all together and everything, she was terrific. I mean, you never know. I don't know why in the world I was feeling that way, but I just kept thinking, she's just not talking. But in fact, she was.
But Mom is very quiet.
Yeah.
She doesn't like cameras. She doesn't.
Yeah,
she's
she didn't
not,
like being there. No.
No. She didn't like that. But her, you know, she's just, she was Dad's life. You know, I mean, really, he worshipped that. It was the rarity. You keep hearing there's no such thing as a Cinderella love affair. That's, you know, Hollywood story. Well, this was the truth with Mom and Dad. I mean, he worshipped. They were married for 42 years before he passed, and he worshipped the ground she kidded the hell out of her. But he loved her, and he was always talking about how great she did things. And man, he was still jealous. I mean, she got dance with Danny Kaye at a party, and Daddy's just looking, and I'm going, oh my God. It was gorgeous. My first date, my date was picking me up. The first time I was going in a car being driven by him, the date.
Yeah.
And he comes in, and I want to introduce him to my gorgeous mom and dad. And this is early, like 7:30, and we go into the living room, which you know, and there they are in their pajamas, and Dad's chasing Mother around the couch, and she's giggling at the for a piece of vanilla, sees vanilla candy cream that she's not going to give him. And he's chasing her, and I'm going, I was so, don't act your age. It's the most gorgeous thing.
Well, sure.
In the world. And
may
that's
we
how
all have
work.
A marriage like that, yep.
I think that's why a lot of the daughters have had more than one marriage. A lot of the guys Billy got lucky. He found Mom and Flossie. But I think we are all looking for a dad. And
that's a hard thing to find. He's quite a personality, you know.
He didn't unzip his fly for anybody else. He didn't have time, for God's sakes. But I mean, no, you know what I'm saying.
Sure.
It's a hard run being a Hollywood family and not having that happen, you know, because it's always there and being thrown at somebody. But no. Dad.
When did you start becoming aware of him as a filmmaker? I mean, did you start watching his movies, or have you just sort of watched them when they come up? Did you ever come to a time when you thought, I should really get to know Dad's body of work? Or
No.
Was there ever anything like that?
No, it was never like that because I always watched. You know, even at the when they went to the premiere of The High and the Mighty. No, we watched them, but it wasn't like we have to sit down and watch Dad's films. I think also when I did start acting, and I was at Desigual Professional Theater Workshop, and I was a fan because a lot of it was more a fan of the actors that he used. I was because Dad also told me as an actor, he said, his advice was, he said, be as professional as possible, not only know your lines, know everybody else's. I'd pattern you after Carol Lombard, Ann Baxter, and Barbara Stanwyck. He said, be one of the guys, know your crew, mm-hmm. the best thing in the world. Always let everybody know where you are, you know, and then have fun. And I had that, you know, when I first started out, I had people on crews that I would be working on a show and who had worked with Dad, and I'd start out being mom for the first day or two, being a lady doing my work and just doing there, and then all of a sudden my sense of humor would come out and I would do that, and all of a sudden they'd start going, Wellman, by any chance, are you related to Wild Bill? I said, oh, my dad, and they said, uh-huh, we could tell, and I went, no, they said, no, that's good. And I said, thank you. But he's, you know, that's, I've always loved his work. Some other, you know, it's like when I've been asked what's my favorite film of Dad's, Great Man's Lady.
Mm.
I loved. Island in the Sky. I loved. You know, those are like my two of my favorite films.
Sure.
You know, those are... You get me every time, I see Great Man's Lady. I'm a basket case.
That's a great movie. I love that one.
Barbara Stanwyck, the aging that she did in that, and how she did that. I mean, Daddy with her. It's just, I loved it.
Yeah, I love almost everything he did with
me
her.
Me too.
Yeah. Oh. So Big, I don't think is that great, but almost everything. It's fine, right. But it's not one of the greats, but. Purchase Price is such a weird movie. I like that a lot.
Well, see, I haven't seen a lot of these.
Oh.
In truth.
Purchase Price is a great pre-code movie because there's lots of lots of really great stuff in it. That I won't spoil for you. I'll let you see it. But, and, of course, Night Nurse, also great.
That was fun.
That's also a great pre-coder.
Gable.
Yeah. And I love when Stanwyck punches the drunk mother and then stands over and says, you mother.
Yes! Which is
it's pretty great for 1933, I think.
Yes! Yeah. Is that the start of that, maybe? Maybe people realize, maybe that was the first of mother.
Maybe.
You know, and Cagney, I got Cagney. Oh, that's what we had a surprise anniversary party for Mom and Dad. Their 40th. And we took care of it because every time they've had to do every 4 years, they've his birthday because of leap year, they'd have to invite certain people. Well, we took it over, and we all worked at getting people that they'd love to see, you know, that they hadn't. I got Cagney, wow. I got Jim over because we'd become friends, and we'd sit at the piano, and I'd listen to him play limericks. Oh my God, talk about Dirty Limericks! He's fabulous. And Richard Brooks, when he was married to Gene Simmons. And we got Bill Clothier. We got just so many different people that he hadn't seen. And when they came in, I had bets going with Brooks. I said, oh, my God, the first thing's out of my mouth is, Jesus Christ. You know, it was going to be like this. He's just hanging. He's going to look at everybody go, ho. And he did exactly that. You know, he just... But when he saw Cagney, because they hadn't seen each other at all.
Wow.
And they just hugged. I mean, and they just, it was probably, I wish that were filmed. I would have loved to have had that for them. Because Dad went 2 years later. But, and the difference, because it was such a short time that he was sick, thank God. You know, and then Dad became the exorcist with the, he was angry for a lot of that, you know, like. Knowing that he was going to die and we were going to live, he'd take it, and he knew it. But he'd apologize afterwards. You know, he said, "Geez,
well, that's got to be rough." I mean, I can't promise that I'll do any better at that. When
me neither.
Yeah.
And the other great thing was watching Dad play the piano down in the living room. And when Howard Keel came over, when they were doing From Goodbye, My Lady.
Yeah.
When a boy becomes a man. And Howard sat down with Dad playing it and started singing it. And I'm just sitting on the steps going, oh, this is heaven. He loved the piano. He loved playing, and he didn't read. He couldn't read it. Did you know that? And he didn't.
Mm.
Yeah. That was great, that Daddy doing that and reading his things. I was the one that copied his book for Short Time for Insanity because it was all handwritten.
Wow.
And nobody could read his writing other than me. And I was reading a lot of it going, Dad, this part with Loretta Young and Gable about that, I know who it is. So everybody else is going to know who it is. Are you sure you can get by with this? I mean, that was fun. That was my one-on-one with him that I just cherish.
I've always been sorry that his second volume of memoirs was never published.
You read it, though.
Oh, sure. I have a copy of it, Growing Old Disgracefully.
Yeah.
It's a mess, I mean, in terms of it's just kind of a hodgepodge of things. But somebody like, I don't know, somebody could really shape it up. And
well, Bill, rightfully, because Dad, what he always said even about Short Time for Insanity was, I'm just writing this for my kids.
Sure.
So with that in mind, Bill, and I'm glad he did say that. You know, he said, I just didn't feel it was in my power, my right, or any of our right to edit it.
Sure.
To have somebody else do that.
Yeah, it's really a family book.
Absolutely.
So I feel honored that Bill gave me a copy of it when, long, long ago.
Yeah, but, I gave it to Britt Brooks.
Yeah, so it's fun to read. It really is fun to read. But it just goes all over the place. Suddenly there's a whole thing on,
I think that's where Dad was at that time.
Yeah.
With the pain and all the stuff he was going through.
Sure. Yeah, it reads a little bit like Short Time. But we should be wrapping up soon.
Okay.
But I want to, before we do, we haven't asked you at all about Clint Eastwood. And you're in The Outlaw Josie Wales. And
Yeah.
And I wondered, because that was pretty soon after he started directing. And
oh, no, he had been directing for a while. Clint had.
Starting with Play Misty for Me.
Play Misty for Me, and I was in that.
Are you?
Can you believe I get residuals? It's hysterical. They hired a girl that couldn't talk, couldn't act. So Clint called me and said, can you help us in looping? Can you just come in and do the what? I said, sure. I just said, what's it rated? You know, with that. And I gave her a personality. I had to just do voice inflections and just changed her whole.
Oh, so you just looped the voice? I had no idea about this. And which character is it?
It was the one. It was the one in red, girl in red, that was her roommate before Jessica comes in.
Okay.
And it's just, you know, that. But I get residuals for it, so I have fun.
Very nice.
Yeah, thank you, Clint. But Josie Wales was, because I wasn't working at that time. I was not trying to work. I was being a wife to Donner and really working his career. And Clint Eastwood and Bob Daly, who was his then producer, you know, were friends. And, we were all friends together. And with Kyle being his son, they just said, what about Sissy for that? And he said, great idea.
Now, how did you know Clint to begin with?
Oh, my gosh. Clint, well,
I call him Clint because we're just like that, of course.
Oh, yeah. Well, he and my then husband were best friends.
Ah, okay.
And also Clint was in Lafayette.
Lafayette, sure.
With Daddy, so it ended up being a funnier connection. But we hung out a lot. We used to we traveled together. We did a lot. And tennis tournaments, everything. Clint's place, we were up. We'd go here. We'd go visit him on sets. We'd just, you know, hang out. And I did a thing for Clint anytime he had. Well, you saw the Quincy I did, so you know that at that time I sort of had a body.
Mm-hmm.
At least one to really show. And
I recommend everyone watch the Quincy episode. Yeah.
No. But he had to do, he didn't want to do this magazine interview, and it was something like Mademoiselle. So he said, "Sis, I want you to come in," because I used to cut his hair. I used to cut his hair. So I go over on the lot, and he says, "But wear something as skimpy as you possibly can and still get by with it." I said, "Okay." So I had this top that just tied around that was, you know, that the midriff was totally non there. And I go in, and he says, "And do be outrageous." So I got my hair as fluffed up as I could, and I go in there. "Is that enough off the side, Mr. Eastwood?" I was doing the whole thing. Well, they ended up never printing the thing or taking the pictures. He said, "Thank you. You saved me." I love Clint. And directing, it was, you know, because he did handheld cameras. I lost my voice for a long time yelling and screaming. Because he had a real specific idea. He listens, which I really like. He will listen if you have an idea or a suggestion. I've done that on occasion with him. And in this one, he took it. I'm sure other people said it also. But it was when you drag the bodies out, it was supposed to be the wife's charred hand that falls out before. I said, "Can't be." I said, "You got to have a little kid's hand, a baby hand. That's going to get everybody." And that's what happened. And also what was the one where the town was painted red?
High Plains Drifter?
High Plains. My then husband was in that. We were on location for a long time. And when we saw the screening, you know, I just went to him and I said, I love it, but I just think it's way too long. He said, "Well, where would you cut it?" I said, "Let me get back to you." You know, but he would listen to what people said, whether he used it or not. But he did that. I loved him. He had a great sense of humor. He was a character. I adored him. He'd go, "Yes, Miss Wellman." He would just do things. I mean, I've always liked Clint.
Did he stay in touch with your dad at all over the years?
No. No, he didn't really know him that way. You know, they did that one film together. He saw him up at, I got them together up at Brooks's because every weekend Richard would show movies. And I wanted Dad to see Jeremiah Johnson. I just loved her. I said, "This is your film, you know, Dad." I said, "Can we run it again for Dad sometime?" He said, "Please." So we got Clint there also. You know, I got Clint up there. So he ran, Dad loved it. And it was just, you know, it was, but they didn't know. No.
I remember your dad really went nuts for "Tell Them Willie Boy Is Here" and actually started writing to trade papers and things like that, just saying, "This is such a great movie. Everybody should see this movie." And the irony being, of course, Carl Foreman was the scriptwriter.
Hello.
Who had been blacklisted. And I think your dad had been perfectly in favor of that blacklist.
Yeah.
At least of Foreman. But
bad times.
But certainly, but he went out of his way to tell people to see that movie. And I thought it was an interesting thing.
I tried to get him back. And Daddy said, you know, Howard Koch was the one when he was head of Paramount. He said, "God, I'd love to get your dad back working." I said, "With the arthritis." He says, "Heck, we'll do the time. If he can't do it, we'll do it. Just let me know if there's something that's, you know, that he might be interested in." And then I read Flight of the Phoenix, and I gave the book to Dad. I said, "Daddy, you got to read this." And he went, "Oh, God, I'd love to do this." And we talked about it, and I said, "Let me get Howard on the phone." So I called Koch, and I said, "Howard," I said, "Dad, we love Flight. Let me get into it. Let me find out." And then he called back. It's already been
Yeah.
Damn. You know, you never know.
That was filmed. The Phoenix crashed at the foot of the sand dune where Fort Zinderdorf was. Yeah.
Wow.
You could
get.
Yeah, if you stand where 1939 Zinderdorf is, you could look right down on where
the
Phoenix was. Yeah.
Wow.
And, of course, that's where Paul Mantz was killed.
Yes.
In that, doing that stunt in that film. So that would have been a rough thing, too.
Wow. You know?
So,
yeah.
Not even doing a stunt. He was just doing a takeoff, and it just went weird. But literally right there in Buttercup Valley in the dunes. It all comes back to Beaugest. With me, it's all one step away.
That's, by the way, that's another great film that I love. I can't see that enough. You know, there's a lot of them.
Well, if you ever want to go down and see the spot where it was made, I'll take you down there.
You are cute. I love that.
You're still, the ground is still covered with bullets.
I've got my bullet.
Yep.
Thank you.
I made sure you got one.
Thank you. It means a lot.
Well, boy, I could sit here for about another 2 hours, but it's been a while, so we should probably let you get back to your own life. But thank you very much, Sissy.
Speaking
of that,
can I do a quick plug on my own life?
Plug away.
I work with a wonderful group called Born to Act Players. They're ages 17 to about 49.
Mm-hmm.
They're with Down syndrome, autism, and they call it special disabilities. They're high-functioning. They're fabulous. We put on two shows. There are 35 of them, and we put on two shows a year. And some of them are actors. They're acting in shows. One was on Glee. She played Jane Lynch's sister.
Oh, yes.
And the other one, Jamie, was playing Jessica Lange's daughter on American Horror Story. So that's my passion now.
That's great. Now, there is a website for this, isn't it? So I will put the link on my page.
BornToActPlayers.com.
BornToActPlayers.com, and the link will be on the commentary track website, so you can check it out there.
Because we have a show coming up May 17th and 18th and 19th.
Perfect timing.
Improv show.
Perfect. Well, Sissy, thanks so much. Or should I say Celia?
No. Sissy, I tried to do Celia and it didn't work.
You were named for your grandmother, right? Celia McCarthy.
For Dad's mom.
Yeah, but they left out the Guinness. I've always felt that was a sad thing. Because that was her name, Celia Guinness McCarthy.
You know what? I hate to say it. I didn't even know that.
You can always turn to me to find out arcane things.
Oh, are you
things.
Kidding? You know that. Why do you think I don't want to tell any dad stories?
I interviewed your Uncle Arthur one time.
I loved Arthur.
Yeah.
We had fun.
Yeah. So... I've certainly elbowed my way into your family way too much.
And No.
I hope it's never been uncomfortable for
you. No, it's so great because you keep him alive.
It's been so much fun for me.
You keep him alive, Frank. Thank you.
Well, that's wait till you see the book that's coming up that John Gallagher and I are doing.
I can't wait.
Just wait. You see this table we're sitting at? It won't fit on it, believe me.
Well, do me a favor. I don't know how much time I've got left, Frank. Let's get it done.
We're trying our best. We're trying our best.
Oh, Jesus.
The thing is already bigger than the Bible, so it's going to...
Oh, God. Oh,
well,
my Lord.
Sissy Wellman, thank you so much. We'll do this again sometime. We got other stuff to talk about. We never even talked about the Waltons. We got all sorts of things to talk about.
Oh, my gosh. I love that.
We'll do a second edition down the line.
Okay. Thank you. Had a ball.
I hope you enjoyed that talk with Sissy Wellman. She is a delight, I think, and always have great fun. And this particular time was the only time we've ever sat down with microphones. So I think I'm going to do it again one of these days. There's Pecker again. Hi, Pecker. Next week, I'm pleased and excited to announce that the guest on the commentary track will be director Joe Dante. This is a podcast that's devoted to film history and to what some people refer to as classic film. And I love to have people who are currently working, people who are still active and making a difference in the entertainment world of today, but I only want them on if they are people who are knowledgeable of film past and who have a love for it. And Joe Dante is aces on both those counts. Hi, Pecker. It's really fun talking with him, and I hope that you will join me next week to hear that talk. And as I said earlier, the week after next, we'll have Bill Wellman Jr., and we'll hear more from him. That was a good long interview, and it's also, I think, fun, and we talked about things that I don't think he's ever been recorded talking about before, and he's got great stories, not only about his dad, but about working with John Ford and Tay Garnett, so he's had a really fascinating career, and just his Star Trek stuff has gained him this rabid fan following that I don't think he ever expected, and he gets mobbed at these Star Trek conventions. So that's a fun talk as well. And Bill is a great guy, and I think you'll enjoy that. Remember to look at the Commentary Track website, where you will see links to some of Sissy Wellman's films. You'll also find a link. There's a link page, and go on that, and you will find a link to her Born to Act Players. And that's easy. It's borntoactplayers.com. And you'll find out more about this really fascinating and wonderful troupe of actors. And they have a show coming up in May. So we have plenty of time for you to plan on it if you live in the Los Angeles area. And I hope that you will all be there, because it's really something to see. And I want to thank Claire McCullough Thompson, my wonderful announcer and even more wonderful wife. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and my personal website, frankthompson.tv. I hope you'll visit them both, and I hope you'll use them both as portals to order from Amazon, because whenever you do, I get a little kickback. If you want to order Redline 7000 so that you too will be able to experience the abysmal Wildcat Jones number with the cute dancing of Sissy and Terry Carr and the other two girls, then you order it through Amazon, then they'll make a sale, I'll make a few pennies kickback, and life will be sweet. Thanks also to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my wonderful theme music. If you're so inclined, you can help support the Commentary Track by hitting a donate button, which is on the front page or the main page of the website. That will take you to PayPal, and you can make a little contribution. I don't get a lot of those, but I get maybe one every couple of weeks. Somebody will very generously do this, and it's a real treat when they do, because this is a situation where I'm pretty much paying out money and not getting much in. And so to help keep this show going, it's a very nice thing for people to help me out a little bit there. So if you're so inclined, please do that. And if you're not so inclined, and I wouldn't blame you, because times are hard, so please have no guilt about this. If you can't make a contribution financially, you can go to iTunes and leave a nice comment and a 5-star review, and that helps get it to more and more people. So I'm even thinking about one of these days starting to read some of the iTunes comments, because we've had some very nice ones. And so far, I think it's just the good part about having a limited, or let's say an exclusive listenership, because everybody who comments has been very generous and very positive, and I enjoy that. I know that someday, if it ever gets more popular, I'll start getting the haters, and right now I don't have any, so I'm thankful for that. And I'm hoping that you'll come in and say something incredibly nice and leave a nice 5-star rating. And if you don't like the Commentary Track, I just urge you to stop listening to it and don't make such a comment, because, well, really, what would it help? Really, come on, look into your heart. So that wraps up another episode. See you again next week with Joe Dante. In the meantime, don't you worry, we'll fix it in post.